Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This is part two of our special on new political parties. Joining me in the studio, Lucy Fisher, senior political correspondent for The Times, and Times columnists Philip Collins and Daniel Finkelstein. So let's discuss what chances a new party has, whether that's Renew or Rubbish or the DMV party or whatever. Let's start with you, Phil. I know you've written a lot about it in the Times.
I don't think the chances of the Rubbish party ascending to government are particularly high. I think if a rupture comes in the political system, it will come from inside, not outside. I don't think anybody's got the capacity to break it from the outside. What people from the outside can and must bring will be energy, vitality, and the sense of novelty, because any movement which succeeds in breaking a completely broken system will have to cast itself as somehow new. And that's perfectly possible from inside. That's exactly what Macron did, actually, in France. It's funnily enough what the SDP did in 1981. You have to have that sense of novelty. So the outside people will be very important, but they can't break it. So if a rupture comes, it will be on conventional terms, because both parties are now led by their Benite wings. And there is an issue which is cataclysmic, on which those parties might conceivably break. And there's a large number of people in Britain who feel politically homeless.
Danny, you were there with the SDP.
My conclusion from that is that what matters about political parties is not just what they stand for or who leads them, but who they represent. In other words, a demographic coalition. And the problem has always been, and Phil and I have discussed this often because the question is, has this changed? The problem has always been that there isn't enough in the social and economic liberal category, combined with the degree of moderation, which is also what a centre party would try to appeal to create a big force, to represent enough people. So you're always going to be creating a slightly unsteady coalition. Now, all political parties are that to some extent. But when you create a new political party and you're trying to create a new vehicle, you need that cogence, and you need to be able to create a big enough coalition to win and to break through in a two-party system. And you need that coalition to be stable enough to survive to an election. What happened with the SDP is that it was able to persuade lots of people at the beginning, but that began to crumble as it got close to the election. So it was having 50%, but it ended up with 25%. Now, there are two questions about this. One, is that still the case, or has Britain changed demographically in such a way that actually that group in the middle would be bigger? And the second is, it's true that you can't probably set up a political party miles before an election, but that's not what Macron did. He did it so close to an election that you created new political reality simply by breaking through. So I don't rule out the idea that you could create such a force, I think it's quite unlikely.
Lucy, what's your take on this? You've written a lot about these, both the new parties, but also the sort of struggles in the Labour Party and the Tory Party as well. Where, if anywhere, do you think the breakthrough might come?
I'm inclined to think that the big battles happen within parties as much as kind of between them. And to my mind, it was pretty telling that Nick Clegg, you know, formerly the leader of then the UK's third party, the Liberal Democrats, is now urging members of the public to join either Labour or the Conservatives. He's not suggesting people join the Lib Dems or smaller minor parties or start their own. He thinks get involved in these established blocs. And they are huge umbrellas. I mean, it is, you know, talking about the need for cogence in a new party. There's not much kind of cogence in Labour when you think that sort of spans from Jeremy Corbyn to Liz Kendall. And then the Conservatives from sort of the likes of Heidi Allen to Jacob Rees-Mogg. Just huge, huge spectrum of opinions about, you know, social, economic, all policy. So I think it's probably worth getting involved in the battle for influence inside an existing political party. And a big part of the reason that, you know, you don't have, for example, in Labour, the right breaking off and forming their own group, at least yet, is that people think that there's a heritage there that's their own, you know, that's as much theirs as it is the sort of the socialists running the show at the moment. So there's that kind of principled kind of cultural significance of them remaining in Labour. And beyond that, there's the logistics, you know, all that data, those kind of regional, local, ward structures that have been built up over years and years and years, decades, is really important. And that's the struggle, the barrier to entry that a new movement faces.
I think they've lost it. I think the argument is that you wait and you regain control. And the last 20 years of British politics has been people of the disposition of me on the Labour Party and Danny in the Conservative Party capturing their party for their side of it and thereby winning the election. I think we've both lost our parties. I think they're gone. The Labour Party very definitely has gone. And I think those people who are sitting there waiting, expecting it to come back, are kidding themselves. And they're simply going to facilitate a dire government if Jeremy Corbyn ever gets into power. And it's ignoble to do that, quite apart from the logistics of it.
I agree with you on the Labour side, just by the sheer numbers of people who are now members in the party. Isn't actually Theresa May and the sort of hard Brexit grip on the Tory party actually pretty weak, that we don't know?
It probably is weak. And the greatest threat to any kind of realignment in politics is probably a sensible Conservative Prime Minister to replace Theresa May, because then sensible Conservatives will have an incentive to stay. And that's entirely feasible. I would suggest probably likely. So that could change it. But I think there is no residual affection for these two parties. I don't believe in this heritage. I was convinced that there has been a demographic change by a very good article I read in the Times. It's by a man called Daniel Finkelstein. Excellent. And he persuaded me against my...
I don't usually like him,
if I'm honest. But on this occasion, he was excellent, full of insight. And he persuaded me, against my better judgment, that there had been a significant shift in the class alignment of voting. I think politics is much more volatile than it used to be now. Politics after a referendum is always more volatile. And the two main parties got 83% of the last elections. He's always given as a knockdown figure. That's a very broad coalition, but I think it's very shallow. Very shallow indeed.
Danny, don't feel obliged to say something nice about Phil, but don't worry.
No, we've had a lot of discussion about this. There is obviously a realignment going on in British politics, which is very threatening potentially for Conservatives like myself. And that is a realignment in which the Conservative Party loses the support of younger and more educated voters, and the Labour Party gains those voters but loses in its traditional heartlands. And I think the Conservative Party, first of all, will face an electoral difficulty in capturing enough of Labour's traditional base to make that electorally pay off. But secondly, it'll become a different party seeking to do that and appealing to that parts of the Conservative message that make an appeal to those new voters. And of course, to moderate Liberal Conservatives like myself, that is a threat. But whereas I do agree with Phil that for the foreseeable future, that battle is lost in the Labour Party. I think it will take a long time to change. I think in the Conservative Party, the argument is still going on, really. And I think that's another reason why it's going to be quite difficult to create a middle force if anyone in the Labour Party was wanting to try. One of the things, of course, they could do is to create basically remain the party. But you have to then assume that all the people that supported Remain think that's the central issue in politics, which they don't all, and that enough of them would come over to you to make a political victory out of it. And I really don't.
No, I don't think it would be that for exactly those reasons. So I think that wouldn't be, that won't be the way it will happen.
And I know there were lots of reasons, lots of questions when somebody's talking about this. But isn't one of the questions that always comes back to is who would lead such a, if there was an impressive person on the back benches on either the Tory or the Labour benches? That would, Lucy, that would make this question easier, wouldn't it? There just isn't anyone.
Yeah, I think that is a real difficulty. And I think that in the UK, people often, you know, talk about Macron, who will be the British Macron. I think it's really difficult. We deride our business classes, our civil servants, far more than the French do. I think there is a there is an esteem for people who make a success in industry or the intellectualism of their public sector, senior kind of mandarins. And I just can't see the people, members of the public, who are fed up with the kind of the gilded elite of the political class. Senior business leaders, other leaders in the highest echelons of public life in other sectors, I think still fall into the same trap.
You've got to remember, the competition here is Jeremy Corbyn and then somebody else, currently Theresa May, but somebody else. You don't have to be that good to be the best person. So let's just conduct a thought.
Well, but having said that, they said that in the summer of 2015, and Yvette Cooper, Chukwuemeka and Andy Burnham couldn't beat Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah, but that's because the Labour Party has fundamentally changed. The electorate in the Labour Party has changed, and the Labour Party doesn't want people like that. So they are homeless too, they just haven't realised it yet. I mean, Andy Burnham's left, essentially, and gone to run a fiefdom in Manchester. And good people will leave. That's what will happen to the Labour Party. If they don't have somewhere to go, the good people will simply leave. But let's just do a thought experiment for a minute. Just imagine, let's just get past the idea this is difficult to supply the system with this party. Just assume that we're going to do that. And the next election is a Corbyn-led Labour Party, a Tory party under, I don't know, Michael Gove. And then you do have a party which is full of really good people, which is led by Chukwuemeka, which has some Tories who have broken off, and which has an absolutely full prospectus and a programme for government, and is surrounded by people who are totally credible. I think that party would do really well.
My message has been slightly different one, which is to moderates in the Labour Party, I've said, well, you actually may not. One of the things about the SDP, which really interested me when I was reading David Owen's memoirs, was that by the time I joined the SDP formally, I was an SDP as a student, but by the time I joined the party nationally, David Owen was already starting to write letters to Mike Thomas, which one of the other MPs, saying he thought the party was over, right? And I hadn't joined it yet. At an incredibly
You're banned
early,
from the new party.
At an incredibly early stage, it became apparent to people in the SDP that they were quite unlikely to keep their seats, that the party wouldn't win a big majority, which was promised by this 50%. They understood that. But they didn't feel they had any alternative morally, because they didn't feel they could support a political party that didn't, for example, support NATO. I've literally come to this discussion from reading one of Jeremy Corbyn's speeches for an article that I've been preparing. And, you know, he doesn't now believe in NATO, the independent nuclear deterrent, and he regretted the breakup of the Soviet Union. Now, people can decide that they want to treat that as completely historical and they're only concerned about their seats, but there's also, with these people, there's a moral question. And the same comes, by the way, for Conservatives. So for me, for example, if a Conservative leader came who didn't believe in abortion and who didn't believe in the legal in homosexuality being legal, I'd find that I'd struggle, not electorally, but morally. And I think that that is one of the issues with the central party. We're always assuming it can only be created if we're sure that it will be successful. But there are other reasons involved in it. And one of the things that Labour moderates are going to have to decide for themselves is, are they seriously going to propose at the next general election making John McDonnell Chancellor of the Exchequer, somebody who regards Trotsky and Rosa Luxemburg and Marx as his heroes, not something I made up, but something he said, so I assume he meant it.
And one of the objectives of such a party would be to prevent a Labour government.
And Lucy, one of the things that you've written a lot about in the Times is the threat of deselections of Labour MPs. And were that to happen, that could be the trigger point where people would think, well, I've been deselected by Labour. I'm still going to be the MP for the next two or three years. If enough of them then broke away and sort of formed a rump in the Commons, then that could be the springboard.
It could. I mean, certainly I've spoken to Labour MPs who said to me in no uncertain terms that that is what they'll do. If they are deselected, they will sit as an independent Labour caucus in the Commons until presumably they lose their seats at the next election. Frankly, if it's at that juncture that they decide to start a new entity or they look to sort of, you know, defect into another party, the whole force of any moral courage that would come from leaving now is totally lost. I can't see any elector thinking, you know, thinking that that would be a noble move, them trying to kind of, you know, scrabble together a kind of last ditch attempt to save their seats. It would just look like political self-interest.
Yeah, the other thing we ought to do, and you know, it's important because none of the three of us, and I can't speak to obviously Lucy's reporter, but are Corbynites. But it's important to look at that perspective. If you look across all of Europe, moderate social democratic parties are doing spectacularly badly, and Jeremy Corbyn didn't. That's partly because of the British electoral system. Partly you can argue he did do quite badly. He didn't win the election, which any other Labour leader might have done. But partly you can see that there has been a decline in the perspective represented by the centre-left electorally, to which Corbyn is proposing, you know, an alternative. So I think another issue that would face this centre party, as well as who demographically does it represent, is intellectually, is it capable of enthusing people, given that that perspective has done quite poorly in all the other countries. So there is a Corbynite perspective.
The answer to that is undoubtedly yes. You keep using a series of terms which are irrelevant terms. Moderate, centre, all these things. No, it wouldn't be any of those things. We wouldn't use any of those terms. Would be verboten. Though we would have to have a distinct political
verboten
thought.
That was the,
that's what we'd call it. That's the name of the party.
Yeah. Tony Greenstein.
It's not. Okay. It can't just be a sort of split your difference retread party where all the people who are disillusioned with their old party simply gather together. It has to be distinct. If it were just that, it will fail. But there is an awful lot of intellectual and political space between Theresa May's Conservative Party and Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, not least simply saying ordinary, obvious things but sounding like you might be competent is a fantastically attractive political proposition right now, because neither of the two parties can command any trust or any assent. So there's actually loads of space, and I just don't buy the pessimism that, oh well, we've the heavy shadow of 1987, it can't, it's different now.
Phil, I'm not quite sure it is just the need to say obvious common sense things. I think part of the problem is that Jeremy Corbyn is coming up with populist, simple solutions to very complex problems. And to take an example, PFI, I think people look at, you know, what's happened with Carillion and think that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn's sort of answer, let's take all PFI back in-house, you know, may, you know, prima facie sound attractive. The difficult thing is to say, well, yes, in some places PFI has been a disaster. In other places, it's worked really well. Let's look into the weeds of which kind of cases fall into which bracket, and look at the reasons why some have failed and why some have been successful. That's all chewy and complex, and against Corbyn sort of waving a sort of standard and cheering with an easy answer, I fear that any kind of new movement would have to give such complex answers that people
aren't interested
in listening to. You've read a
government which is unbelievably chaotic, trying to do the most complex administrative task of post-war British politics, and they are still on 41%, and the Labour Party hasn't gone anywhere since the general election.
Okay, then, just because I'm conscious we're running out of time, do you think, yes or no, that there will be a new party launched before the next election, Phil?
Yes.
Danny?
No, on balance, I don't.
Lucy?
Yes.
I don't actually know. I'm going to take the Lib Dem option, so I'm not sure. My hunch is there might be one and it'll be rubbish. That's my
but
prediction.
We weren't allowed more than one word.
Right, to rubbish with a capital R.
I think we're all right behind the rubbish party, the franchise. We can just buy a franchise from Sally. That is all we've got time for this week. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your Android device so you never miss an episode. Get my free morning email all about what's happening in politics at thetimes.co.uk/redbox. My thanks to Lucy Fisher, Daniel Finkelstein and Phil Collins. For now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.